You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
You are a neurologist and basically a co-founder of the investment management firm Efficient Frontier Advisors, but you're a neurologist. I love when people who are neurologists decide to write, you know, tour de force books.
Yeah, and a neurologist with a PhD and an MD.
Not bad.
Not bad.
The kid
yeah,
is good.
No, but you know, I can't dance when I'm no good around the house. everybody, and I have no eye either. I mean, everybody has their skill set. I mean, if you have 3 minutes for the Shaggy Dog story, I gave the short version to Hunter.
Give it to me.
But if you've got 3 minutes, I can give you the Shaggy Dog story.
I want to hear it.
Okay, well, you know, I live in this country that doesn't have a functioning social welfare system. So I was forced to save and invest on my own, and I approached it the same way that I thought, or I thought the way that I thought any scientist would do, which is to look at the peer-reviewed literature, study the basic texts, collect data, build models, test those models. And after I had done all that by the mid-90s, I found that I had something that was of use to small investors, which gave rise to all three of my finance books. And after I wrote Four Pillars, which was my second book, I wanted to write some history, because history is so very important to investing. If you don't, you know, you can be the world's most brilliant math wonk and financial analyst, but if you don't know history, you're dead in the water.
I love that you say that. I love hearing that. That makes so much sense to me, but keep going.
Yeah, and so I wrote Birth of Plenty, which was modestly successful. It wasn't a flop. And then about 10 years ago, I got a phone call from this guy named Brando Skyhorse, which, you know, is an even funnier name than yours, Hunter.
I was going to say, was he on an Indian reservation? Or?
Was he the second cousin of Lando Calrissian?
Yeah, his father was Native American, but his mother, who raised him, was Hispanic. And he was raised in East L.A. And went on to have a fairly distinguished career in publishing, from this very disadvantaged background. Went and got lots of scholarships. And so he calls me up and he says, "We want you to write a book about world trade." And I said, "You know, I don't know anything about it. I'm not interested in it. And you've got the wrong Bernstein. You want Peter Bernstein?" And there was this awkward silence. And he said, "Okay, we actually had lunch with him last week, and he's not available for this project because he's writing the history of the Erie Canal." And I said, "I know that." And I said, I'll think about this." So I went into my family room, and my wife was finishing the New York Times crossword puzzle in her coffee, and she puts them down and she says, "You know who Grove Atlantic Press is?" And I said, "Well, no." And she said, "Well, you know who Grove Press is?" And I said, "Yeah, Doris Lessing, Henry Miller." And she said, "Right." And I said, she said, "You know who the Atlantic Monthly is?" And I said, "Yeah, I've heard of it too." And she said, "That's Grove Atlantic Press. If you value your career as a nonfiction writer, you will write whatever they want you to write." so that's how I came to write Splendid Exchange.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't matter who told me to write what, even with a gun to my head, I couldn't do what you do. So, you know, and this book, you know, I really just appreciate when somebody can kind of articulate. You do such a good job in The Birth of Plenty of kind of showing, well, you say it, how the prosperity of the modern world was created. Why, for example, the fascinating chapter on why Islamic societies did not keep up with the West, even though, you know, about 500,000 years ago, they were vibrant societies that contributed a great deal to sort of the thing. And you break it down. I'll read a little bit here, because I have a lot of young people that come to me and they listen to this podcast and they say, "What do I read? What's something I should read?" I always start with Guns, Germs, and Steel. I think it's an excellent thing. But I would put this in the same category.
Well, and so would the back of the book.
Yes.
And a fascinating, irresistibly written work that recalls Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel. You know,
There you go. There you go. Yeah. But you break it down. You break human progress down into four different things. I think property rights, which drives creativity, you say, scientific rationalism, which permits the freedom to innovate without fear of retribution, capital markets, which was a great part of the book because I hadn't really ever thought of it in those terms, and which provides funding for people to pursue their visions, and transportation communication, which allows for the effective transfer of ideas and products. I guess the you know, I had never really thought, I know that property rights are very, very important. I talk about it at times. You know, it's part of the things that makes, you know, when you invent something, you've got to be rewarded for it. When you have a society, a powerful central government that comes along and says, thank you, that's our idea now, you're just going to stifle creativity. The way you couch these ideas are very approachable, and I think every young person should read the book, because it really does give you context for why the United States is the country that it is. And more importantly, and I want you to comment on this, for me, the book gives me great ammunition against those people that would suggest the United States should move, you know, more in the direction of, say, Western Europe, a large central authority that dictates, you know, how we should do things. And rather, you know, it's almost the book feels like a celebration of what the free market really should be, and how you keep a free market, and how you keep a society vibrant and progressive and prosperous. That's where the value of the book is. That's, I know I'll be quoting and using it against my socialist enemies.
Here in Southern California, yeah. The People's Republic of Santa Monica.
Yeah, and I think it's a very, and that's why I think it's such an important book. So maybe talk about that a little. My guess is you believe in free markets, sir.
Well, up to a point. People read Birth of Plenty and they assume that I'm a free market advocate, mm-hmm. and I am up to a point. But there's this dynamic.
I mean, wait a minute. You do live in Portland, Oregon, so let's start there.
yeah, and after all, you know, I spent enough years in Berkeley and close to Eugene as well.
You subversive.
The People's Republic of Santa Monica has nothing on the People's Republic of Eugene.
You probably have a beard and you probably ride a bicycle. You lefty
stalker.
Right. My God, you got me dead to rights.
Awesome. No, I want to hear your point of view, of course, on that.
Yeah, I'm thinking seriously of studying tattoo art and food cart management as well. but more seriously, I think that Paul Samuelson had it right, which is, you know, we've tried socialism and communism, it doesn't work. We've tried unbridled free market capitalism 120, 150 years ago. Quite frankly, that didn't work either. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to have a balance. And the fulcrum between those two ideals is in the cost of enforcing property rights. Clearly, property rights and the enforcement of property rights are the key to the whole thing. When you look around the world today, that's what cleaves rich countries from poor countries, is how rigorously property rights are defended.
And by the way, I should say that you devote time to what, not when people think property rights, they think, well, the right to my house and nobody can take it away, but intellectual property rights are very important.
Yeah, they are, and we'll get to that in a minute. But the trick is that when you have enormous disparities of wealth, defending and enforcing property rights becomes very, very expensive. And the places where you see that are in a lot of developing countries where you have these enormous wealth disparities. And you go around to rich neighborhoods and you see that nice houses are always surrounded by high brick walls topped by razor wire and glass. And when you see that, you know that you're in an inefficient society, because those societies are spending way too much money defending property rights, because the vast majority of people are starving. And you want to avoid that. You have to have some leveling of wealth, particularly in a technologically driven society that becomes a winner-take-all society. You know, it used to be that there was an opera house and there were opera singers in every decent-sized city. Well, you know, now you can't survive as an opera singer in Peoria because, you know, the 10 best opera singers in the world are all on CD or downloadable. You're getting all the money. Mm. And so we've evolved into this winner-take-all society, and I'm afraid that if we're going to maintain property rights, we do have to have some redistribution. So I'm not the free market Milton Friedman capitalist you think that I am. I think everything is worthwhile in moderation.
I think that's a very, very valid point. And I think about that a lot. We are navigating. I mean, as a comic, I deal with that all the time. It's you know, I can shoot a special, which I'm about to do, my second special. I'm not going to make any money off that because it's so easy to download. So what I do is I have to actually, the way a comic and a musician makes their money is I actually have to physically show up in a room and have people come and pay tickets to see me. The special that I do, I mean, I'll make some money, but for the most part, it's kind of an infomercial for, hey, look at Brian Callen if you want to come see him do stand-up. And by the way, I should mention, Dr. Bernstein, I'll be in Portland, Oregon, March 15th and 16th, so come on out. I'll let you know that. But I mean, that is the thing. I guess you're right. I mean, there are so many things to navigate with the exponential growth of technology. But I never really thought how important enforcing property rights are. That is, you know, it's kind of like I heard somebody break it down to the, you know, society into saying society can be broken down into the things you learned in kindergarten. Don't take what doesn't belong to you. Keep your promises. And if those two things break down, you've got to make amends. You've got to have an enforceable way to make those two things right, to put those two things back in their place.
Yeah, or as Madison put it, you know, if men were angels, there would be no need of government. It's pretty much the same way. You know, the other strain that you raised, which is very interesting, is the importance of intellectual property rights. And again, you know, that's not an absolute. And in fact, really, you know, since the time of the law of Anne, 300 or 400 years ago, lawmakers have very wisely realized that you have to balance public interest against private benefit. So that if you invent something, you don't get the rights to it forever. You get enough rights to it to reward you that is limited in both time and scope. And then after you exceed that time limit or the scope is exceeded, it belongs to the public, and the public benefits from it.
I'm thinking about pharmaceutical companies have to deal with that all the time, right, where their patent kind of runs out in 10 years, and then they've got to kind of give it up to a generic.
Sort of. What they've learned, what the pharmaceutical industry has learned to do, is to make a little tiny change in the medicine, and then they patent that for another 21 years. Yeah. There's a medicine that I used to prescribe all the time called Dilantin, which is a very simple molecule. It's very cheap to produce, and it's been around for 70 or 80 years, and it keeps getting more and more and more expensive because the drug company keeps tweaking it.
Yeah, that's right. It's really kind of a scandal,
actually.
Yeah, there's a book I just read called Bad Pharma about that by Ben Goldacre, and that's exactly right. They're just unconscionable. I don't know how they live with themselves. But, you know, the big pharma is they'll do what they have to. I hope they can, you know, if they want to pay their mortgage that way, go ahead. But we don't do that.
I don't think they're worried about paying their mortgage, Brian. I think they just walk in with fat sacks of cash and are like, yeah.
Maybe I'll come up with a way to come up with a better molecule.
Anyway, what I used to you know, tell people about how a medical office worked is if you saw a very attractive young man or woman in the waiting room with you who had a briefcase, you know, that wasn't a patient.
That's right. That's a pharmaceutical rep. That's right. That's exactly right. So do you think that property rights, are you optimistic? Are we getting better at enforcing property rights around the world, or does it vary on a case by case basis? Are we getting better in this country?
Well, it's you know, there's two different questions. One is around the world, and in fits and starts, it is becoming apparent to leaders around the world that the societies that enforce rule of law, that enforce property rights, that have equality under the law, they function better. They're stronger. Mm. They're more likely to defeat their neighbors that don't do that.
Right.
And they also acquire legitimacy as well. You know, I mean, the thing that destroyed the credibility of Viktor Yanukovych, obviously, was that he was a thief.
Yeah.
And that gets to, you know, the power of modern communications technology to send these stories around the world. So, yes, we're getting better. Obviously, it's not a uniform, you know, progression around the world. There are setbacks aplenty. But if you look at the world of property rights enforcement today compared to what it was 100 years ago, there's no question that we're getting better all the time. In this country, You know, I tend to be fairly optimistic as well. We have over a million lawyers in this country. There's probably far too many. But one of the benefits of our society is that it's basically run by lawyers who do understand the importance of these institutions. You know, in China, all of the leaders are engineers, and people make that into a virtue. But China's leaders don't understand the importance of legitimate institutions the way American leaders do. Where you can have someone, for example, like Al Gore say, you know, I know I won the election in 2000, but it would be too destructive, the institutions, for me to carry the struggle against the electoral results any further. So for the sake of the country, I'm going to let it go.
But that's what I think is so, that's what I loved about this book. You do such a good job of making that argument, and the argument is very difficult to read. I was watching the Sochi Olympics, and they had Putin on there. I swear to God, I said to myself, Putin should read this book because it you win the argument. You know, the ideas are way more powerful than any gun or any army at the end of the day. I mean, an idea. And this is a book of ideas. The book, in some ways, I like the book very much because it talks about the turning points in history, but it also talks about these amazing ideas, the idea of scientific rationalism, property rights. These are ideas that somebody came up with, and they are, there is an objective truism to it. I don't know if I'm using the right word, but it's hard. You can't argue with you. Reading a book, you make a very, very good case for how important this is. And I feel like if a lot of nations or leaders read this, like for the Chinese or the Russians, it'd be very difficult for them not to realize that they are essentially dealing in they're walking anachronisms. They're working with a bankrupt idea. It's never going to be as good as, because I always say the United States is basically what makes the country great is it's an idea. The Constitution is an idea. The American character is an idea, an adherence to an idea.
You know, as long as we're talking about the good things about the United States, and not everything about the United States is good,
no.
The best thing is the way that we treat young people with respect. And you know, young people, you can say that we can say they're narcissistic, they think only about themselves, it's me. But that, in a way, is also a very healthy thing, because ask yourself, for example, what would have happened if Bill Gates was a Japanese young man who dropped out of the University of Tokyo in his senior year? He'd be finished.
He'd be finished. Mm-hmm.
Right? No one would have ever, you know, given him capital. No one would have ever let him start a large company or supported him. He would be dead in the water. So we, you know, and of course, human beings are the most creative when they're young, when they're in their 20s. And if you're a brilliant, you know, 20-something in the United States, you can make something of yourself, even in the academic world. You know, if you're a brilliant young physicist at age 25 or 30, you're probably going to get tenure. You're not going to get tenure at University of Tokyo or at Heidelberg.
Yeah, there's too much reverence for your ancestors, for tradition, and all that kind of stuff, where it kind of hems you in.
Well, and I kept having this weird thought. So firstly, I just want to say I love this book. And for me, the real test of a book is how often do I feel the need to get out my pen? you know, and I mean, my copy of The Birth of Plenty is just like covered in highlights and questions.
You're
and all
such
that
a nerd.
Stuff.
You're well, such a nerd. I love it.
But I kept on wondering, and you know, maybe it's an unrealistic thing, but I kept on wondering if there's some way to synthesize these four things that you're talking about into one, because so much of it seems to be about, you know, what, you know, the scientific method is really about a way to recombine ideas and innovate. You know, property rights is to make sure that those ideas can then be carried through in a way that the originator feels like they have a return on investment. Is there sort of like one big message that all four of these things serve to maximize or optimize?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you look, the paradigm I use in the beginning of the book is, let's say you're an inventor and you want to bring something to market. Well, the first thing you need is you need to know you're going to get at least some of the benefit, and that's where property rights come in. If you're not going to get any of the benefit of it, you're not likely to invent anything. Next, you need models of the world that enable you to understand the physical world enough so that you can make your invention function properly, if you will. That's where scientific rationalism comes in. You have to know how the world works. And then once you've done those two things, you can build prototypes. That's all that Edison needed to produce his first light bulb. But Edison had a problem, which is that in order to bring light bulbs into people's houses, he needed, first of all, to produce millions of them, but even more difficult than that, he needed a power grid. He needed a reliable source around the country of electricity. And that required, even back then, billions of dollars. And that was more than this, you know, even the biggest bank could put together. So, of course, J.P. Morgan got together a consortium of banks and funded Edison Electric. And then once you've got all these widgets, you know, sitting in your factories, these millions of widgets, they need to be transported and advertised. So that's where transport and communication come in. So you can think about the paradigm. You can tie it all together just by thinking about how something comes to market.
Mm. You do a great job of, and I'd never heard this argument, when you talk about how Islam, the fact that the Middle East has not developed in step with the West has less to do with the actual religion and more to do with local culture. I've never actually heard that argument. You know, there's the idea that the Quran is a blueprint for how society should work and usury is not allowed, so you can't really have efficient capital markets and et cetera, et cetera. It's very hard to separate church and state. But in fact, you make the argument that was not the case for much of Islam's history, or at least, you know, half of Islam's history.
That's the really interesting thing is when you study the birth of Islam, you realize what a close-run thing it was, and that it's really just an accident of history having to do with a couple of very peculiar historical events that the prophet wound up the leader of this, not only religion, but also of this culture and the start of a vast empire. The Arabs could have easily wound up as a Jewish kingdom, strangely enough.
Really?
Or for that matter, if luck had turned the wrong way, a Christian, Abyssinian influenced kingdom. And they would be the same today as they are, as they wound up under Muslim influence, because it's not Islam that makes them the way they are. It's the fact that they're a traditional society.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be a traditional Jewish society, or they would be a traditional Christian society, but they would be just as fundamentalist
Christian or Jewish
as modern Muslim Arabs are now.
That's an interesting argument. Why their traditional societies? Why their traditional society is so resilient and ours not so much then?
Well, that's the really interesting thing, and I got into that in Splendid Exchange. It has to do with the camel. You know, the camel has this long, very complicated evolutionary history that starts in North America, and it was doomed for extinction, okay, because it wasn't fast, it tasted very good, it wasn't able to defend itself against predators, and it was very rapidly about to disappear until human beings domesticated it. And the reason why human beings domesticated the camel is because it's the best, it's the world's best beast of burden. Mm. A single camel can carry about a quarter ton of cargo at 4 or 5 miles an hour.
What? A quarter ton? A single camel can carry that much weight?
Yes, an F1 cross camel.
Wow, a quarter ton.
Can carry, and of course, a single trader, Bedouin, can lead a train of 4 to 6 of these things. So one man can lead a ton of cargo across the desert at 4 or 5 miles an hour if he can walk that fast.
So that's incredible. We're talking about that's a lot of weight.
that's where the word caravan comes from.
A quarter ton. A quarter ton.
Right, exactly. One camel, a quarter ton.
We're talking about 500 pounds.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah.
Brian, would you like us to convert it into pood some other traditional unit?
It's just a lot of. I never think of that thing, but I guess it makes sense. You can carry a horse can carry 250 pounds. So yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Never mind. I got a little too carried away there. Sorry about that.
So, but that's not the really interesting thing about the camel.
Yeah.
The camel, the thing that enabled the camel to survive, and its one evolutionary advantage is that it can live long periods of time in a hot climate without water. Mm. So it can live in the desert, and if it can find an oasis once every week or two, it's fine. Well, this animal enabled the Arab peoples to basically disappear into the wastes of Saudi Arabia, away from their predators. And who are the predators of the Arabs? Well, they were the first and foremost the Byzantines. Mm-hmm. To the northwest. To the northeast, there were the Persians. To the southwest, there were the Abyssinians, the Ethiopians, the Christian Abyssinians. And they all wanted to destroy and subjugate the Arabs. And what the Arab peoples could do was they could disappear away from these predators into the desert using the camel. And so they evolved a society that basically enabled them to live as a small tribal society away from any governmental influence. And so the cultural aspect of the Arab peoples that is so detrimental today is this utter distrust of a depersonalized, non-secular government that the camel enabled them
to fascinating. This is why I love doing this podcast. I get to talk to people like you. I lived in the Middle East for 8 years of my life. I've ridden camels more than 10 times. I've even, believe it or not, galloped on a camel. So, and I'm not kidding, even as a kid. But I just never thought, that's incredible. That's incredible.
I'm told they're heck to steer.
Well, I just rode it, and I was little, and it didn't matter, and I just, you know, I don't even remember.
You can't even really steer it. I mean, the camel has an idea.
You've ridden one.
I've ridden multiple camels. I'm not as much of a camel jockey as Brian is.
That's
I mean, they definitely have an idea of where they're going, and that's why, you know, if you're not an expert camel rider, you just need someone leading it along.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'll end up...
I mean, that was the whole thing with Arab armies, is that they did use camels. But when they really needed to attack someone with any precision, they had to use horses.
Right.
Yeah, because I think I was on a track in Saudi. I think it was in Saudi, and you actually have a stick and you hold on something, and I just hit it and just rode the camel. I've ridden horses enough to know, but it's very, very. It's like a loping. When I say gallop, it's a pretty easy thing to do.
But it's an incredibly uncomfortable experience.
Well, for you. But
yeah.
I have a callus on my taint. and that's the most important thing. Anyway, but fascinating. Fascinating.
I'm sure that, Mr. Bernstein, that you have never, ever had an interviewer use the word taint around you.
It's Dr. Bernstein. He's a doctor.
There's a first for everyone.
You never forget your first taint interview.
There it is. I always, you know, one of the issues that I would always hear about, when people say, well, the Arabs are very tribal, and that was always the problem. But you've just put it into, you know, context for me now.
Well, and I mean, that's interesting in terms of because obviously we've really seen a very strong libertarian streak arise in this country. Brian sometimes describes himself as a libertarian, and that distrust of central government. But central government is important to ensuring those property rights, to ensuring the functioning of these four factors that serve innovation. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, every time I get on an airliner, every time I drive on an interstate highway, every time I put a pair of pajamas on my infant granddaughter that I know isn't going to catch on fire, I thank God for the federal government.
You know what? So do I. So do I. You're right. You're right. You get on a plane and you think, I'm glad that there are federal standards, you know, that are going to make sure that this plane is very safe, right?
How would Milton Friedman, ask yourself, handle airline safety? He would say, well, let's let the market handle it, okay? The companies have to keep their airliners safe. If they crash their airliners and kill too many thousands of people, they'll go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
That's how a libertarian approaches airline safety.
That's right. That's right. And in a way, he might be right.
Yeah, but there's
I know what you're saying. It's all of us would like to know. It'd be very easy, and using children is an excellent example. I want to know that whatever my daughter is drinking out of is not toxic. I want to know that there are federal standards
for
that.
In spite of the federal standards, it may still be toxic. Mm. But I think that's the thing, is so much of because we live in such a specialized society, you know, there are going to be gaps in our knowledge. Brian spends his days doing stand-up and podcasts and reading books and all that sort of stuff.
And boxing.
And he's wrestling. Amazing. I mean, just one
and
of the...
And playing tennis.
That's right. Brian is not really representative, but I have many limits in my own knowledge. And do I really have the time to really evaluate airline safety in any sort of intelligent way as a shopper?
Right.
No.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think I'm with you, Dr. Bernstein, on all that. You devote part of the book to the future, and you are an optimist. You sound optimistic about the future, but we are dealing with things like just technological innovation and biological innovation and things like that that are going to push us beyond our biology, already are. How are we going to navigate that stuff?
Well, here's the trick. I mean, I've just read the scariest book. I finished reading the scariest book I've ever read in my life, which is Eric Schlosser's Command and Control, which is about the U.S. nuclear arsenal. And, you know that nuclear weapons are bad things, and they can produce a lot of damage. What you don't realize is how close we came on many occasions to vaporizing the planet, and on one occasion we came within one fuse of basically vaporizing the entire state of North Carolina.
What?
Wow.
Really?
It's a fascinating book. So as human beings become more productive, our destructive productivity, if you will, becomes much more impressive. Also, I mean, we've gotten to the point where one person, one rogue colonel, can kill millions of people, and it almost happened a couple times during the Cold War. I mean, one of my favorite historical characters is a guy by the name of Vasily Arkhipov, and he's not a man who anybody's ever heard of unless you're aware of the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he's the man who saved the world. Literally saved the world. He was the political commissar, strangely enough, on a submarine that was being bombarded with dummy depth charges by some Nimrod of a U.S. destroyer commander during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And of course, the guys on the submarine, the Soviets on the submarine, didn't know that they were dummy depth charges. They thought it was for real. And the captain and the XO wanted to launch the submarine's nuclear torpedoes, and Arkhipov said no, and they needed all three of them to agree, and so the two of them looked at him and said, you know, when we get back to the USSR, you're getting a bullet in the back of your neck.
Wow.
And when he got back home, of course, he was hailed as a hero.
Wow.
And so that's how close we came.
Wow, that's scary. God, what about North Carolina? What happened with
that? Well, that was a B-52 accident, and I don't remember exactly how many hydrogen bombs, but these were very high-yield weapons, 10-megaton bombs on the order of. And a 10-megaton bomb is basically enough to destroy a state, rendered uninhabitable if it drops in a ground burst.
Jesus.
Air burst might only destroy a great big city, but a ground burst produces so much radioactivity it basically renders the city uninhabitable and probably kills people from radioactivity as far away as New York.
Oh my God.
And so four of these weapons dropped. Three of them didn't come close to exploding, but there were, I think, five safety devices. And four of them failed on this one weapon, and the one that prevented the accident was one that had a long history of failing, but this particular one worked.
Good God.
Yeah. And there were literally, I mean, this wasn't just one accident, there were literally, and that's the thing about the Schlosser book, is he documents literally dozens of these accidents.
Mm-hmm.
And the more typical accident actually occurred on the ground. The typical accident was, you know, an F-100, this old fighter jet, that would be carrying one of these big heavy weapons under its wing or under its fuselage, and it would be taxiing, and the thing would catch on fire, the plane would catch on fire, and maybe the pilot would get out, maybe the pilot wouldn't, and all that would be left would be this large puddle of radioactive metal sitting on the runway.
Oh my God, that's safe.
This mix of plutonium and this 50,000 pound puddle of mixture of plutonium and aluminum.
Well, who the hell is going to clean that up?
Brian actually uses that to remove hair from his chest.
It's a salve.
That's the problem that we have. The question that you've asked is, we've now had 200 years of per capita GDP growth of 2% per year, which means that we become wealthier once every 36 years. If you do the math, we double in wealth every 36 years, and if you do that for a couple thousand years, you wind up with this unimaginable wealth. You wind up with people with a per capita GDP that's maybe a sphere of gold light years in diameter. It doesn't make mathematical sense. And so the question is, it's got to stop somewhere, maybe. And the obvious way it stops is that we blow ourselves up. That's the last chapter of the book, is how long can we sustain this? Because we're in Terra Nova. We've only had this regime of 2% per capita GDP growth for the past 200 years.
That's right, yeah.
And, I mean, that's so much of it is that, you know, the power for destruction is becoming democratized, as is everything else.
Yeah.
Right.
I'll tell you, the best $20 I ever spent was when I took a man by the name of Bill Baumol, who's a very famous economic historian, out to lunch. And I asked him this question. You know, I said, so does this continue forever? Do we wind up in 5,000 years all producing, you know, with a per capita income equivalent to a sphere of gold light years in diameter? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, yes, it's going to happen.
Wow.
And this is probably the world's best informed, certainly most authoritative economic historian.
So all we have to do is live 5,000 years and we'll be rich.
That's right. We'll know the answer to the question. Whether we've blown ourselves up or not.
Well, in the book, you talk about the difference between because society can be rich, but then there's something called standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is something that's very, there is sort of becoming more of an equality of consumption. Everybody has a flat screen TV, or a lot of people have cell phones, even though they don't make a lot of money, and et cetera, et cetera. So technology is making it, but most people are not starving, whereas most of the world was starving. Most of the world is not enslaved in terms of not getting anything for their labor. The world in many ways is getting better. The world in many ways is getting richer, and in many ways all of us are.
We're not getting happier. That's the problem.
Well, that's another thing you talk about. I'm glad you brought that up. That's interesting to me. Explain that. By what metric do we measure happiness? And you talk about this in the book. I'd love you to dive in on that.
Well, I don't know if I can remember the quote precisely, because remember, I wrote this book 12 years ago. but I believe it was H.L. Mencken, I always mangle this quote, who said that a rich person is someone whose salary is higher than his wife's sister's husband.
Yeah.
And that's basically how we measure happiness. You know, we're like chickens who have a pecking order.
Yeah.
And the higher up you ascend on the pecking order, not only the happier you are, but also the healthier you are. And this is something that's very well demonstrated. There's a classic study called the Whitehall study, done by a British researcher, a famous British researcher named Michael Marmot, who looked at civil service workers in England who, you know, within a factor of two, all have the same salaries. And the only difference among them is that some, you know, have bachelor's degrees and have lowly clerical positions. Some of them have master's degrees, and some of them have the equivalent of PhDs or high office. And so it turns out that the people at the top of the pyramid were much healthier, even though they weren't much wealthier.
Okay? Right.
And they were healthier because they had status. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And the classic example, and there's some statistical flaws with this, but it's still a good example that resonates in Hollywood, is if you look at people who've won the Academy Award, all right, they on average live 4 years longer than the same person who has been nominated the same number of times for the Academy Award but never got one.
Oh, God.
Right? Because when they go to the party, everybody pays attention to them.
Yeah, I've never been nominated, damn it. So what does that mean?
Brian, no. Maybe you need to explain to the Academy that they're killing you.
That's right.
Exactly.
You know, that is very interesting in Outliers. I think it is with Malcolm Gladwell. He talks about a town called Rosetta in Pennsylvania. where this group of people, these Italians who came from the town of Rosetta, I think, in Italy, they set up their own sort of little enclave, but they were so supportive of each other, and the community was so strong. And they were generally very happy people. They spent a lot of time talking and napping, and you know, they worked in the rock quarry. But they were so supported. There was such support among all of them that even though their eating habits weren't very good, they were usually very heavy. They were dying of old age, not heart disease, when heart disease was an epidemic in this country. And I'm talking about the 50s, and I think of the early 60s. So they had to start looking at health as in different things. It wasn't just biology. It was status. It was community. Community made a big difference in how people felt about themselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's the problem that you see, for example, in a lot of Eastern Europe, particularly in Russia. It's just a very non-communitarian culture. You go into even an apartment building that's run and owned by wealthy people, and the common space is dingy and ill-maintained, even in the most expensive apartment and condominium buildings in Moscow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's because it was planned on a board.
They're not willing to maintain that common space.
Well, it was planned on a board. It was not planned. It was not scaled to human beings. Cities are supposed to grow up but with the people that live with them. It's an organic thing. When Robert Moses destroyed the Bronx with the Cross Bronx Expressway, he destroyed the fabric of an entire society. He ruined that area. That guy's a bad guy. But he was of the school back then. He did it with some German architect. I can't remember the guy's name, but they planned these things on a board. They weren't thinking about human beings. They hadn't really grown up around that kind of thing. They were people who they were arrogant enough to believe that they could plan other people's lives.
Did you ever see?
It's what made Jane Jacobs such a hero.
Yeah, I mean, did you ever see Le Corbusier's plan for the center of Paris?
No.
He basically wanted to destroy everything that Haussmann and that whole crew had built, and basically erect skyscraper after skyscraper in like rectilinear grids.
Yeah, that's why I don't have Albert Speer. Don't have Nazis and communists plan your city for you. It'll be a bad situation.
But I'm glad you brought up Jane Jacobs, because that's to talk to our listeners a little bit more about Jacobs.
Well, I have to admit, I don't know an enormous amount about her, aside from the fact that she was Robert Moses' nemesis, and that's basically how she became famous.
Yeah, she led a lot of...
That's what she's famous for and beloved for.
Yeah. She saved Soho, I think. She kind of was like Robert Moses wanted to take what was Lower Manhattan and run a huge highway through it, and she mobilized enough people to kind of stop him from doing so.
And I think this all ties into something that's much larger than what Jane Jacobs represents. Is that we're starting with the human being and really understanding how do human beings work, what do human beings needs, and then essentially building out architecture and everything else from that. And that's a lot of, I think, what we're seeing happening in the last 20, 30 years is the fact that we're increasingly returning to, it's great that we have these abstract theories, but our first principle, what we should start from, is the human being. Like, how do human beings actually work? What is an economic, behavioral economics is all about saying, okay, it's great to have the idea that everybody is rational, but let's look at actual people. They're clearly not. And so working within that, what sort of economic system should we have, and so on and so forth.
And of course, the big question, the most difficult one, is what is the role of government? You don't want you don't want the government designing your cities, but on the other hand, you do have to have government looking over private sector economic development. You need government at least regulating it. You go to the great cities of Europe and you shudder. What would Venice look like if it were, given over to real estate developers?
Oh my God. My God, you're
it
right.
It would look like the Grove is the answer.
God, you're right about that, man. You are right about that. Every time I talk about being a libertarian, and people hit me with those kinds of things, and I go, free market capitalism we'd have McDonald's on every corner and Starbucks. So that's one of the things I hate about. I travel so much in this country is that cities in this country have lost. We've become very homogenized. I mean, it's changing a little bit actually. It's a bit of a a pushback, but for the most part, you travel, and man, have we paid a price for efficiency and abundance to an extent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we took our kids traveling when they were much younger. And about 25 years ago, we decided to take them to Southeast Asia just to show them what the rest of the world looked like. And we joked to them that we were taking them there to show them what it looked like before it disappeared. And I remember being in a train station in Bandung, and we walk into this place, and the first thing we see is a Dunkin' Donuts. And my wife and I looked at each other and said, too late.
What a bummer. I remember Europe 20 years ago and 25 years ago. I remember Europe being so different. You'd go there and people dressed differently. It was just different. Everything was different in the United States. And then now it's exactly the same. I mean, there's really no difference. I mean, New York City is a European city.
The one difference between you know, the airport in Hanoi and the ones in the United States is the one in Hanoi is much nicer.
That's crazy.
I mean, it's a legitimate thing. I mean, my dad always talks about this. You know, he's Dutch and, you know, has lived all over the world, but he always talks about how, you know, we have a legacy of infrastructure in this country that is ultimately going to be a real drag on our productivity. You know, we have, because we set up some of the first electricity systems, some of the first telephone systems, you know, there hasn't been that design from the ground up.
I mean the water that you know New York City residents drink generally comes through pipes that are more than a century old.
Yeah. Wow. And clearly we've learned things about how you do that, which I think it's so funny as well when, you know, people get so excited about, oh, look at Shanghai's public transport system or whatever it is. Well, they're benefiting from an extra century of having done this.
Yeah.
You know.
Or more subtly, when you look at Singapore, you say, look at them. They've got public transport. They've got a public welfare system. They have fabulous public health care. You know, they're libertarian. You know, they're extremely well-run society, and they only run 20% of their GDP through the government. Well, that's what happens when you don't have any legacy costs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And Lee Kuan Yew, who's basically a benevolent dictator.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and I mean...
Benevolent and honest most of the time. Yeah.
Yeah. He was great.
And not just legacy costs. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, the United States provides naval operations for most of the world. You know, that's a major, you know, cost that we have to pay that someone like Singapore doesn't really have to. I mean, they have... Yeah.
Going
back to Birth and Plenty, that's the most remarkable thing when you look at the math is that, you know, as Paul Kennedy figured out, when society starts spending more than 25% of GDP on the military, they crumble. They can't sustain that. And right now, we, in spite of the fact that we're spending half of all military expenditures are on our military empire, this enormous, very expensive, very sophisticated, very effective machinery, it's still only about 6% of GDP.
Wow.
And during the height of the Cold War, it was 10%.
I didn't know that. That's amazing. I was just with two very elite soldiers last night, retired, but Delta Force guys who were telling me about, I was astonished. The drones, the cameras, they can read your face. They can read from 10 miles away your driver's license. I couldn't believe it. I was blown away.
I'm trying to remember the book that was written by the SEAL Team 6. It was the guy in SEAL Team 6. It was No Easy Day, which was actually a remarkably good book.
Yeah.
And what the book was really about wasn't about the mission so much, but it was about their training, which is obviously very rigorous. But what most of the book was really about was all the toys they used.
Yeah. That's right.
It was you know, just all this technology that they were trained to use, these boats that you dropped from C-5s and then ran into the water after in your frogman suit, or the, you know, the 20 different kinds of assault rifles they used depending upon what mission they were using, or these little tiny helicopters they would ride on the skids and get dropped on the buildings and then rappel down the buildings. I mean, it was all this equipment they had to use to do their mission. It was quite remarkable.
It really is remarkable. I mean, my buddy was able to, you know, he said, we use facial recognition from the drones. We're not making any mistakes. I'll tell you that right now. You also kill a bunch of civilians, by the way, if they happen to be in the house with him, but he's a high value target. So let's all relax here, guys. You know, I mean,
and Chelsea Manning might disagree with that too. But besides the point. Yeah.
I mean, come on. So that raises a whole different subject. But who are your historical heroes?
Oh, dear. Well, I can think of two right off the bat from Birth of Plenty. One of them is Edward Coke, It's spelled C-O-O-K. We would pronounce it Cook, but the British, I guess, pronounce him Coke. Or maybe it's the other way around. No, it's Sir Edward Cook, and it's spelled C-O-K-E. That's right.
Right.
And he was the basically the Chief Justice of England during the time of James I. And he, you know, that was a time when the monarchy was still asserting the divine right of kings, and he asserted judicial supremacy. All right, and he almost won. He lost the battle, but he won the war because he winds up in Parliament and basically says to King James I, "Well, screw you. You know, we're going to assert legislative supremacy now and parliamentary supremacy." So he basically affects rule of law over the divine right of kings. And he's also, you know, he's
the father of sort of common law, right? I mean,
law. He's certainly the person who brought it into the open and made it acceptable.
Right.
And he also made a lot of case law having to do with property rights as well. He's probably one of the fathers of modern prosperity. And then the other person who's my hero of the story is Edmund Halley, and the reason why Halley is such a hero is because he's involved with so many of the different factors that enable prosperity. So obviously, you know, he's a champion of scientific rationalism. He's also a champion of capital markets because he developed these statistical tools that we use in the insurance industry, which is a very important part of the capital markets. And then finally, he was behind a lot of the scientific advances that gave rise to the steam engine and the telegraph, the scientific ideas that were the progenitors of those.
Two people I'd never heard of.
Edmund Halley can almost be thought of as the great father of Western prosperity.
And just to get for context for listeners, and you talk about this in the book, you know, Halley is the guy behind Halley's Comet.
Exactly.
Right. And that's the funny thing is that, you know, we know him for this comet that comes around every 80 odd years. But of course, you know, his contribution was so much more significant than that.
That's right.
It's just that the Halley's Comet is a great soundbite.
Well, the book we've been talking about is The Birth of Plenty, but you are also the author of The Intelligent Asset Allocator, The Four Pillars of Investing, which is a classic, according to my father, and The Investor's Manifesto.
And The Splendid Exchange, and most recently, Masters of the Word, which I started reading Masters of the Word as well, and it's utterly brilliant. And it's brilliant for much of the same reason that The Birth of Plenty and The Splendid Exchange are so brilliant, which is that so often, I mean, you know, if you think about American history, you know, it has this, it's really like a trilogy, right? Mm-hmm. We think of it as there was the American Revolution, then there was Civil War, and then there's whatever's happening right now at this moment, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you do such a good job in all of your books of really connecting the dots and showing, oh, it wasn't just these revolutions. It was, you know, a series of revolutions with, you know, people like Edward Coke and, you know, Halley and all of the figures along the way. I thought what you said about, you know, why Athens was able to achieve aristocracy was because of farming patterns there. I mean, that section was brilliant.
Mm. Well, thank you. Yeah. So those are sort of my favorite characters. I mean, my favorite story, that's one of the wonderful things about writing nonfiction, is you come across these remarkable stories, and a lot of them are things that people really don't know about. I mean, for example, the largest act of coordinated mass terrorism in the history of humanity came in the year 88 BC when the Greeks rose up against the Romans, who were literally enslaving them, and on a single day in that year killed basically all 100,000 Roman inhabitants of Asia Minor.
Wow.
On a single day.
That is that's called mass slaughter, man.
Yeah. And coordinated. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's
it was coordinated by this man, this king, Mithridates VI, who's better known as the Poison King. All right, he's the guy who supposedly fed himself poison in small doses and made himself immune to it.
Man.
But his biggest accomplishment was this episode of terrorism. My favorite story, I think, in all of my books, though, is the story of the Boston Tea Party, which wasn't an uprising against taxation, unjust taxation, taxation without representation. It was basically a protectionist riot.
How dare you?
Yeah. Here's the funny thing, is the Tea Act of 1773, which is what they were objecting to, was really a free trade act. It enabled the East India Company, for various not-so-savory reasons, to come into the United States and to, or the colonies, and to sell its tea directly to consumers, which would have cut the price of tea in half. It would have cut out the middleman. But, of course, the middlemen got very upset, the tea merchants and the smugglers as well. And so the tea merchants and the smugglers, who were going to get their axes gored, were the guys who put on the blankets and the war paint and dumped the tea into the harbor.
Wow.
And, you know, there's an obvious modern cheap shot that I could make that I won't, because I don't want the listeners to think less of me.
Well, it depends on which listeners, but we already think a lot more of you.
Yeah, this has been an ass-kissing fest, but, you know, it's always fascinating to talk to somebody like who's put out the kind of effort you have. So it's much appreciated, and I know my life's better for it. I mean, it's a learning experience, but I'm looking forward to getting into the other books, and we'll have you back if you have time. Do you teach it in Oregon?
A little bit. Yeah. You know, I just did a lecture last night at the local urban state university campus. And I do a little bit of teaching in high schools and in colleges, and I'll do the odd Skype course, you know, many miles away.
Right.
But no, I don't have a formal teaching.
You write. That's what
I write. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to grade papers.
Yeah. I love it. Well, exactly. Well, I promise you, I'm going to hit you up the March 14th, 15th. I'll be at Helium in Portland. So you got to come out, and I promise I'll make you laugh. You're not going to learn a thing, but I'll make you laugh.
Oh, Brian, don't be modest.
Yeah, we'll have some fun. Have you been to a stand-up show?
No, I don't think I have.
Well, prepare to be amazed, sir. Prepare to be amazed. I can't thank you enough, man. Thanks for joining the show, man. This has been great, and we're going to put your books on our website, The Birth of Plenty, and you guys should go to the we'll put them all on. I mean, The Four Pillars of Investing, and go through the Amazon banner and click on that and buy the books.
Because if you buy the books through the website, money goes to Brian.
And you, Hunter.
Well, so,
and the studio.
And the studio.
I've made no money at all on this podcast.
$0.
But that's okay. It's all about learning. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. William Bernstein. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
MD, yeah. PhD.
MD, PhD. God, I would abuse those degrees. I'm going to see you in Portland. I'm not letting you get out of it.
All right, send me an email.
I will, my friend.
Thank
you very much. And that's been the Brian Callen, Hunter Mott Show, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you learned everything. You could actually read all his books and learn a shitload.
As a trilogy, like Birth of Plenty, Splendid Exchange, and Masters of the Word, it really is. It's everything that you missed out on in school, because it gives you a way of looking at the world that is really coherent and complete. And
he's going to be in my reading list, you know. Hunter and I were talking about, I'm writing this book called The Manual. It's an open letter to my daughter and my son about, you know, everything I've learned in case I die, what to read, everything on hygiene, health, fitness, everything I know, why learning how to fight is important, the whole thing. So it's going to be ridiculous. But Hunter's going to help me shape and create this thing. So we'll have it for sale or for free, depending. Well, maybe we'll have me on the podcast.
Oh, God.
Hey!
Brian, you may be the only man who could interview yourself.
Damn right. So, Brian, how'd you do this? I don't know, man. It just came. It just came out of me. I'm funny as shit. Guys, just so you know, I'll be in, I don't know when this is going to drop, this episode, but whatever. I'll be in San Francisco this weekend. You'll probably miss me by the time you hear this. And then I'll be in, I'll be in Minnesota.
Bloomington,
Minnesota, at the House of Comedy, biggest mall in the world, I think. And one more thing. I know that the reads that I do, the commercials I do, are kind of a pain in the ass because they're pre-recorded, and it's my fault. So I'm going to start doing live reads so you guys don't feel weird about it, because I hate interrupting the podcast with, and now sponsor from da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But your tweets and your comments are much valued. A lot of people are like, dude, please, with the commercials, at least put in some effort and talk to us. And I'm like, all right, I'm sorry. So there it is. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.